This is the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, editor-in-chief of Feminem. Now, I am sad to say that today I am bringing you the last of our Fix 18 content. This is it, everybody. So there might be a little bit of a lull in our podcast content. We'll kind of see what happens over the summer months. We might take a little bit of a break, but we're going to bring you podcasts as we see fit. But do not worry, Fix 19 is really actually just around the corner. Tickets are on sale now, so make sure you get yours. Don't get shut out. It's happening in September this year. And right after that, we'll be raring to go with some more Fix 19 content. But for our last, our final Fix 18 piece, I have a great one from Dr. Jennifer Brokaw called Advanced Care Planning and Serious Illness Conversations Can Save Lives and the Practice of Medicine, One Emergency Physician's Experience. Now, Dr. Brokaw is an emergency physician who has worn a variety of hats over the years. Previously, she was an NIH clinical research scholar studying the health effects of domestic violence on women. And then she transitioned into a private practice, which she founded, that worked in advocacy for patients and end-of-life management. It was called Good Medicine. In her Fix 18 talk, Dr. Brokaw shares her experiences in this practice and the importance of advanced care planning and serious illness conversations, both for the patients and for the practice of medicine. Enjoy.
Shout out indiscriminately your favorite procedure in emergency medicine, the one that really makes you feel like a badass or that you've saved a life with or that you had difficulty with and then you mastered. What? Oh, wow, I didn't hear any of them. Okay, one at a time. Nurse made elbow. That's an awesome procedure. Raise your hand and I'll call on you so we can hear some. Oh. A subclavian. I love that one too. Anyone else? Lumbar puncture. Yes. Anterior shoulder reduction. Yes. Clunk back in. That feels so good. Procedural sedation. Aha, yeah. Using what? Propofol or ketamine? Yeah. Okay, how about some of the more serious ones like rapid sequence intubation, cardioversion, defibrillation? Yeah, I mean, that's why we went into the specialty kind of, right? I mean, it's very satisfying to master those procedures, to be taught them and to do them well. What I'm here to talk to you about today is about another procedure, because we all know that those procedures that you do, when they go well, feel really good, but sometimes they don't go well, and they're a flail, and they feel terrible, and sometimes people die because you did a procedure to them. But even worse, and what I found in my 14 years in the emergency room is that sometimes I did procedures to people that I felt really bad about, even when they went well. And those were people that were older, at the extremes of age, or really sick, had been through something, and were at the end of an illness, and didn't necessarily know it, and they showed up in the ER. Show your hands if you've done something to someone you didn't feel so great about. Yeah, it's the majority of the room. So I did something about it, and I started a practice called Good Medicine. I thought I was going to fix things. And what I found is that people were coming to us. We were a private practice, out-of-pocket pay, with really serious illness, and with no clue about where they were in their disease spectrum, that even though they had seen a primary care physician or an oncologist or a cardiologist, nobody had talked about prognosis with them. And there I was with my newly minted shingle as a patient advocate and problem solver, and I found that unless I knew where they wanted to go and what was important to them, I couldn't fix things for them, and it was often me that had to break the bad news to them that they were going to die. So I did what any anybody would do. I went to get more education. I went to Harvard Medical School to Practical Aspects of Palliative Care, which is a course I highly recommend that focuses almost solely on communication. And it's a role play course. Damn difficult, let me tell you. And I really, something that the course director, Susan Block, said at the course stuck with me. And that is that any advanced illness conversation is like a procedure. It's technical. You have to learn how to do it. You have to practice it. And anytime you do it, you have to prepare for it, just like you're a surgeon or an emergency physician going in to do any other procedure. And the more I've practiced in this realm, the more I think that that's true. Why do we have these conversations with people? Well, look at this stat. I call it the 48-48 stat. In 2014, JAMA Internal Medicine published an article that looked at hospitalizations in people over age 65. And they found that 48% of people over 65 needed a major medical decision made on their behalf, so they weren't making it, within 48 hours of their admission. I hope you guys remember that next time you write admitting orders or call medicine on an older patient in the ER, that it's 50-50 whether somebody else will be making a decision for them very shortly. And with the population of age 65 and over exploding, that's a lot of hospitalizations. Moreover, I want to point out that the decision makers they found, 78% of the time were women. So I came to embrace the notion of advanced care planning, which is a cousin of the serious illness conversation. And I dedicated me and my team to become masters of that procedure. So I put up a technical definition of advanced care planning, but basically it's two conversations. One is with a patient, and then the second one is with the patient and their healthcare agent or proxy, and then ideally their physician too. And the first conversation is long, it's lengthy, and it's involved. Some of the questions that we in our practice at Good Medicine asked people in the advanced care planning conversation were things like, what gives your life meaning? What do you still hope to accomplish? What's on your bucket list? But there were at least two questions that I started to call the money questions. And I've designated them the money questions up there. One of them was, do you have a strong preference about where you die? Do you want to die at home? And of course, that's important because decisions that are made for people when they're in the hospital need to be made well in advance if it's very clear that they want to die at home, right? And the second money question was, what experiences have you had with others who have been ill or who have died? And I learned that when I asked that question of people in an interview, I had to have a box of tissues out because they would invariably break down and cry. Everyone's had an experience with someone else, and a lot of people have had the experience of having to be the decision maker for someone else. And unfortunately, because most people don't make their wishes or goals or values known about their end-of-life preferences, the decision maker is left with a lot of guilt. And in fact, of the people with serious illness in this country, only 12% have discussed their wishes with their physician. Only 12%. That's an astonishingly low number for a lot of reasons. Partly because it's been shown that 80% of patients with serious illness want to have this discussion with their doctor. And I believe that it's the doctor's job to bring it up. It isn't the patient's. The doctor has to know how to broach this with their patient. And I believe it takes training, which we don't get. There are many benefits to advanced care planning. I'm not going to go through all these, but one of them includes decreased litigation, which is important. But the most important thing, in my opinion, about advanced care planning is that people who undergo advanced care planning are more likely to access two very high-value treatments, and that is palliative care and hospice. And I don't know how familiar you guys are with this end-of-life literature these days, but the big breakthrough in the last 5 years is that researchers in palliative care have shown that if you take two groups of patients with the same terminal illness, the same stage 4 lung cancer was the famous study, but there have been others since then, and you put one in early palliative care and one in usual care, who lives longer? The palliative care group, that's right. But then if you go back and look at the hospice literature, this has been known for decades. So people who access hospice earlier live longer than their cohort with the same diagnosis who access hospice later. It's so counterintuitive, maybe, right? So I like to say that advanced care planning, oh, and by the way, the amount of time that people live longer are like 6 weeks to 3 months. And if you look at any of these new cancer immunotherapies, very few of them offer any more than that. So I like to think of advanced care planning and palliative care as the latest and greatest life-saving drug. So you may be sitting here thinking, I'm an emergency physician, I don't really need to know this stuff, but I want to tell you that training in this kind of conversation impacts the conversations you have every day in the ED. When you obtain informed consent from a patient for a procedure, when you discuss code status, obviously, when you give discharge instructions to somebody, that's a teachable moment. That's a moment that you may be telling them something they didn't know about their health. And then providing anticipatory guidance all requires these skills of serious illness conversation. So I'm not going to discuss this at length, but our healthcare system is not set up to embrace advanced care planning, although a lot of hospitals are trying. The economic incentives for advanced care planning are just not quite as robust as they should be, because at the end of the day, advanced care planning is about limiting aggressive care at the end of life, and a lot of hospitals don't want to do that. There are CPT codes now, and I'll get to those at the end of my slides, but a colonoscopy still pays more for the amount of time advanced care planning takes. So at Good Medicine, we got really good at advanced care planning, and we had done a couple hundred couples, and somebody told somebody who told Jane Brody at the New York Times about our practice, and she wrote an article about us. And that article, after it was published in the New York Times, made our phone ring off the hook from New Yorkers wanting to do advanced care planning. So actually, my partner and I flew out here to New York in 2012 and did 2 solid days of advanced care planning with New Yorkers. And that is how I met Ed. And this is a representation of Ed. It's obviously not him. It's a pretty good representation in terms of body habitus, but he was in his mid-60s. His wife, Terry, called our office and told us that she was really interested in she and Ed getting advanced care planning done because they were going to retire in the next 5 years and had 2 grown children, the typical story of why couples came to us for advanced care planning. I had the unlucky draw of drawing Ed as the person that I would interview for the advanced care plan. And it was tough. He walked in and sat down and became the master of evasion. I asked him about his medical history. He said he had some hypertension and high cholesterol, but he gave me a detailed analysis of why he thought cholesterol wasn't really the culprit for coronary artery disease. I asked him what he understood about life-sustaining treatments, and he said, you know, yeah, I know CPR isn't very effective. And I asked him about his spirituality, and he talked for about 15 minutes about Buddhism and his spiritual beliefs. And I finally looked at my watch, and I was like, wow, an hour's gone by, and we have not gotten anything substantive here. So I went to one of my money questions, and I asked him if he had had any experiences with anyone else who had been ill or who had died. And that's when Ed told me about his dad having had a stroke. And he said, you know, my dad had this really bad stroke. And when he got discharged from the hospital to rehab, he had no motivation to participate in rehab. He was just done. And my sister and brother were really mad at him because PT and OT and speech weren't gonna give him, you know, a pass. And they were going to kick him out of the rehab center if he didn't progress, but I could see he had just lost all motivation. And, you know, if that ever happened to me and I just wasn't motivated to go on, I hope my family would understand that. So that was about as close as I got to anything of substance, and I'm furiously writing this down, and I look at my clock and I'm like, gee, you know, we have to wrap up here. And I said, anything else? And Ed thought for a minute, and he said, yeah, you know, when I was in the ICU after my dissection, oh man, flail. I took a deep breath, looked at my watch, and said, oh boy, what was that like for you? And he talked, you know, a little bit about how difficult it was not to be able to talk, to be paralyzed, how frightened he was. And I said, wow, Ed, I had no idea that you had gone through something so serious. So he's like gathering up his things. He did not want to talk any further about this. But I slipped in a, God forbid anything should happen again. Is there anything you would want your family to know? And he said, I'll think about it, and left the room. Well, I walked out of the room just feeling like crap. I mean, I was charging good money for this. I had been written up in the New York Times, and I just flubbed it. And sure enough, when we sent patient satisfaction surveys to all our clients that we saw in New York, Ed gave me a really bad review. I didn't blame him. He said, I seemed disorganized, I seemed uncomfortable, he wasn't sure where I was going with the interview. All true. So I called Ed and I said, look, I'd like a mulligan, no charge to you. I'd like to talk to you more about your wishes. You know, I've written up your plan, your wife has reviewed it, but, you know, I think there's more here. And he said, I'll get back to you. He never got back to me. So, fast forward 2 years, we've closed the practice. We really couldn't sustain, you know, our rent and malpractice insurance with an out-of-pocket pay business model. And I get this weird email from an email address I didn't recognize. And it was from Ed's wife. She said, Jennifer, I've been trying to track you down. Good Medicine had closed, and the phone wasn't working. But I wanted you to know that Ed died last week. And she said, your directive was so important to me and my son, that the stuff you wrote about Ed's father, for us to make the difficult decision to withdraw him from the ventilator. And needless to say, I still cry when I say this. I cried when I read the email, and I realized how important the work that I had been doing at Good Medicine, although the business didn't exactly succeed monetarily, and I sacrificed a lot. I was, you know, an emergency physician making good money and feeling really good about myself, and I took a big chance to start this practice. And I realized that I had been making a difference in people's lives in a different way. I'd been saving lives in a different way. So that's led me to conclude that, you know, I believe that these conversations and mastering them is a physician's most important job. It's more important than knowing how to do an LP. It, maybe not more important, but as important. It's as important as a rapid sequence intubation. Because people's lives don't just consist of them, it consists of their family as well. And I was lucky enough to write an editorial in JAMA Internal Medicine last month about another case in which my skills as a difficult conversation physician came in handy at someone else's end of life. So I've continued to use these skills to help people. It's the most important job we have. Thankfully, now there are CPT codes that I wish we had had at Good Medicine, or I think we'd still be in business, that pay for advanced care planning discussions. Still don't pay as well as a colonoscopy, but it's something. And I'd like to leave you with this before cocktails. One, the column on the left has a nice set of resources for DIY directives, advanced care plans that you should pass on to your family. But the column on the right are some excellent resources for physicians. So I haven't been practicing emergency medicine for many years, but I still get the flyer for the difficult airway course. And instead of signing up for that, I really want you to consider signing up for one of these difficult conversation courses instead. Thank you.